All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Anti-War Radio. Next up is Philip Weiss. He keeps a blog called Mondo Weiss, The War of Ideas in the Middle East. MondoWeiss.net. And he's got a lot of other great writers there as well, as you are probably aware. Welcome back, Phil. How are you doing?
Great, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us.
I'm not mistaken,
today's Friday,
show.
So that's cool.
Yeah, oh man, I can't wait for the weekend.
There you go. Yep. All right, well, we'll try not to, this isn't going to be a very weekend-like conversation. It'll be serious, probably, but maybe we'll like try to figure out a way to lighten it up a little. I was hoping you could teach me a bit about all the ins and outs of Israeli politics and, I guess, the American side of them as well. Over the past couple of weeks, especially to start out concerning the call for early elections by the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and then a deal struck with the Kadima Party, which I guess had been the odd man out among the major Israeli parties. Is that right?
To go ahead and
keep a new coalition.
Yeah, I guess it's been dizzying. And the best headline I can give to your listeners is that Netanyahu has now solidified his political support in Israel. And to frame it my way, you know, I've often said in the last year, hey, American liberals and liberal Zionists, all these people who support Israel but call themselves liberals, they should bring down the Netanyahu government. People like Peter Beinart and David Remnick, these people who say they hate the occupation, they do hate the occupation. You're such liberals, you're so worried about the future of Israel, well, bring down Netanyahu, end his support in America. And looks like I'm really wrong, because whatever influence these liberals in America have, Netanyahu has now reached out and sort of solidified his power and put off any kind of vote about questioning his authority for another till he comes up in 2013 anyway. He solidified his power by including the quote unquote centrist liberals of the Israeli spectrum, and it's a real right-wing spectrum, but he's included this big power called Kadima, which I think means center. He's included them in his governing coalition. They were outside the governing coalition. And part of the weakness of Netanyahu was people said, oh, he's got all these right-wing settlers and religious Orthodox people supporting him. It's a real right-wing coalition. He's got all these people who want to toss Palestinians out of Israel, ethnically cleanse the place even more, and religious nuts. That's his coalition. Well, guess what? Now his coalition includes these more secular types who were in the center, who had been in opposition to him, and essentially he's got the whole Jewish spectrum of Israeli politics on his side, with the exception of a few small pockets. And his votes in the Knesset, the governing legislature, the legislature, which were, you know, he used to have like a tenuous majority there, cobbled together out of these right-wing parties, he's now got like 94 of the 120 Knesset legislators on his team. And it means that he might be a little bit more liberal in some of his policies, but not much. But it also means that he might be girding up his loins to strike Iran. And so it's a very troubling development, and just shows us that Israel is a really right-wing place. And a right-wing leader like Netanyahu is supported overwhelmingly by that society, a guy that we would just find completely objectionable in our political discourse because of the racial talk he goes in for. There is completely legitimate.
All right. Well, a few things there. Now, back when, let's see, I guess it was at the fall of Olmert and the rise of Netanyahu again. Daniel Levy said, this is Israel of the three Likuds, because you have under Ehud Barak, he was the former prime minister and the leader of the Labor Party, and he joined the coalition as the defense minister, right? So that compromised Labor right out of the deal, put them under Netanyahu, and Barak moved way toward Netanyahu's position anyway. And then you had even further to the right, this Yisrael Betnu party of the Russian, like, secular but hardcore right-wingers, right?
Yeah.
And that's Avigdor Lieberman and his whole group there. And then the odd man out of the group then was Kadima, which was Ariel Sharon's party, which was, the way I understand it, and this is a too simple version, I just don't know, but it really, I think the only real reason that Sharon split off from Likud was maybe a personal difference with Netanyahu over who ought to have more power, and B, tactically speaking, should they leave a few settlers inside the Gaza Strip or not? Back in 2005. And then, but so otherwise, Kadima, they can call it center if they want, but it was already the Likud party in the first place. It was Ariel Sharon's party.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's true. But Scott, but help me here. I need to ask you a question, which will help me in our conversation.
All right.
You know, I live in tunnel vision here. You know, I'm a New York, upstate New York Jewish guy who's obsessed with this issue. So it's all I care about, I mean, since the Iraq War, I'm an American first, and, you know, the Iraq War is what made me focus on this issue, but I'm a tunnel vision kind of guy. Do your listeners follow these, do they know these names, Sharon, Netanyahu, Barak? Are they following these politics? Do they understand, what is their degree of awareness about the significance of these kind of political mutations?
Well, I think folks in the neighborhood don't know anything about it. I live in a world of antiwar.com where I got access to all the most important news all day, every day, all the time. And links to you because your stuff rules, right? So this
in
is,
area,
you know, I
area,
live in the
you.
Same tunnel as you as far as the information, the level of the quantity of information absorbed or whatever, right? But really, I just asked myself, well, what did I think when I was like 15 or something? And what I thought when I was 15 was that, yeah, there's this place called Israel over there, and maybe I'll learn about that stuff someday, but not now. Right? Like, I think that's pretty much what most people think about it. They don't know the first thing about it.
Including me. I wanted nothing to do with it and didn't really care about it, and then it was the Iraq War that forced me as a Jew to explore that. But I guess I'm wondering, do you see any signs that Americans generally are beginning to cotton to this the significance of the Netanyahu or just that whole little client state that's wagging the dog, the tail that's wagging the dog? Are they waking up to that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think pretty much anybody who's into alternative media sources is probably going to go, "Huh, wow." But TV, I don't think ever. I don't even think. See, like on the Lehrer News Hour, they might say, talk about the occupation in the West Bank or whatever, but they'll never say, okay, here's the deal, all right, and explain. There was a war, this occupation began back then, and this is the degree to which it's occupied and cut up into little pieces now, and this is why that's a problem if you ever want to have a permanent peace deal, whatever. They don't ever teach, like, the Israeli occupation 101 to the American people on TV ever.
Right.
I remember seeing on MSNBC, Mika, I think, Brzezinski was sick, and Joe Scarborough was out too. So it was Pat Buchanan and Mike Barnicle and the Queen of Jordan. And they actually sat there and had a real discussion about Middle East politics like adults on TV. Yeah. And it was the most unprecedented, shocking, incredible thing in the whole world. It was like you had never believed before.
Wow.
You'd never seen anything like that on TV. That's, you know, to me, a good measure of it is if it ever happens, you can feel how different it is from the usual, line or the usual degree of attention or explanation, you know.
That is
different. We're up against the break. We got to take it, and then we'll be back with Philip Weiss from the Mondo Weiss blog, mondoweiss.net. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Philip Weiss from the Mondo Weiss blog. And it's got a lot of other great writers there as well. You really ought to check it out. Lots of great stuff all the time. A very interactive comment section. etc. And so, yeah, now, another part of your question before the break was, you were asking me, what do people know about the Israel-Palestinian conflict, Israeli politics, etc., where I'm from? I think in the neighborhood, the answer, like I said, was not very much. On the other hand, my listeners know all about it, because they're really antiwar.com and readers of things like your blog, etc. They absolutely can keep up when we're talking about who all's doing what in Israel and what it means when... Well, here, let me ask you this, because I think this might sound a little bit inside baseball, but it's really important to me. I read one thing that said maybe the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, from the hardcore right-wing Russian secular party, will be out and will be replaced by a Kadima guy who's anti-Iran war. Maybe I even read that at your blog. Do you know about that? Is that possible, you think?
That's one of the turns in the story that I have not followed. I mean, I've seen that as speculation. I think, first of all, let's say that it was a masterstroke politically, and like many masterstrokes, it's going to be dissected for a long time, and no one is having big... The guy who did it is not explaining his motivation. So we're all sort of spellbound by Netanyahu right now. Yeah, I mean, well, give it up to Netanyahu. This is a guy who got... Let's remind ourselves, this is a thug. I find him to be a thug in his personal demeanor, who got 29 standing ovations from the American Congress a year ago. A man who gets 29 standing ovations from the Congress is a pretty good speaker, which he is. He's demagogic as a speaker, but he's also got a ton of political power in our country. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, was leading those standing ovations. She was jumping up and waving her arms to tell everyone to jump up and give him standing ovation. And that's the problem that, again, I get to so often is, here you have a liberal, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, on any number of issues in our country, a leading liberal, and she's supporting a right-wing guy who has completely racist policies towards Palestinians. Now, to your point, I think that, yeah, there's a chance that it would mean that Lieberman is out. Lieberman is too much for Americans. Even American liberals have trouble with Lieberman. You know, maybe he'll get rid of Lieberman and just solidify. Is this just going to solidify his power over Obama? That is one of the brilliant things here, is that we thought, I would say, all they have to do, all the liberals have to do is knock out Netanyahu, and then Obama can go forward with his liberal agenda of sort of supporting a Palestinian state. No way, man. Netanyahu just solidified his support. He's got it fence post to fence post in Jewish life in Israel. And now American Jews are just going to line up behind him even more. So, and isolate anyone who criticizes him in the Jewish community. So it's going to be a battle, but Netanyahu's winning.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Because I guess, if the foreign minister is an anti-Iran war guy, that doesn't necessarily mean he'll be in any position to check whatever Netanyahu wants to do.
Yeah, I think
it only means that people in America will be less concerned time, anyway.
That's true. And I think the guy they're talking about is Shaul Mofaz, who was born in Iran, but who said, hey, if they have a sword to our neck, we're going to go after them. And so some have interpreted this as paving the war, the way to war. And I just think it's interesting to watch Obama. Obama will be less critical of Netanyahu than ever, because the American Jewish community will say, well, he's got all of Israel behind him.
Well, now, when it comes to Iran, I know you have here this piece, Neocons and Goldberg see coalition as heightening the likelihood of war. And you got Elliot Abrams here at the Council on Foreign Relations and Charles Krauthammer. What do you make of all of the more, very influential people in Israeli society who have basically been coming out very publicly saying what used to be only small voices in the wilderness, pointing out that, hey, there's actually no evidence that the Iranians are even making nukes at all. Now that seems to be the very official position of a lot of leakers to Haaretz in the last couple of months, right?
Yeah, well, I think that what we've seen is waves. We've seen waves from both sides. We've seen the warmongers wave coming at us again and again, and that's what you're seeing right now. And we've also seen the realists wave. And you know, any person who looks at this situation has got to say this is the most ridiculous, crazy thing in the world to go to war with Iran. It's absurd, you know? And just even from the standpoint, and Obama's got to be saying that, even from the standpoint of gas prices, what's going to happen to gas prices, you know? If they go to war on Iran, I mean, it's going to give us, you know, $6, $7, $8, well, that's getting, I mean, who knows? Who knows what the price of gas will be? And the point is that any realist looks at this situation and then looks at the human costs and just and says this is absurd.
Well, then again, so Netanyahu, he could look at the Congress and all their ovations as meaning he's bulletproof and he can do anything.
Right.
Or he could look at it like, wow, there's a great thing I ought to not ruin.
Yeah, well, that's true. But, you know, as you pointed out, we're finally getting these voices in Israeli society that are allowing Americans to say this is a crazy idea. It's Israelis who are saying they're messianic, and we don't trust them on it. So just last week, these former security chief of Netanyahu said he's messianic. I don't trust him on Iran. Well, Netanyahu just slam dunked him because he's got this broad coalition. He may be messianic, but he's got everyone behind him.
Yeah, and by messianic, they mean he wants to be like Winston Churchill.
Oh, God.
Who got 60 million people killed, or something pretty close
to
that.
Yeah. I mean, just think how many millions could die in this conflagration.
Well, and that's the whole thing of the leaks to the New York Times about the war games, about how even the most limited bombing campaign against the enrichment sites or something like that would lead to regional war. It would always escalate. We tried it 6 different ways, and it always escalates to a war. I mean, look, we already have Iraq would be on Iran's side and Syria's side right off the bat if it came to something that big.
Oh, yeah, you know? No question. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just pure craziness. And yet, this war party is in our government and has been there for a long time. It's in the Obama administration. This is the party that gave us the Iraq war, and now it's more naked. Now it's more patently the Israel lobby. That's the only one who wants this war.
Well, now, so what do you think about, you know, domestic politics wise? Do you think Obama is going to try to take advantage of the opportunity for talks here and come up with some kind of real deal to have a good reason to have not bombed Iran to tell the lobby while he's running for president? Or is it going to be more in his domestic political interest to go ahead and scotch the talks and say, see, you just can't talk to those crazies and then bomb them or promise to bomb them next year or that kind of thing? Or what do you think is going to happen?
You know, your guess is as good as mine, but I would say my guess is that this is the last thing he wants to do, and he is going to make nice and stroke those folks but not do it. I just don't think that, look, right now, he knows this guy's a sensitive, smart guy, and he knows his legacy right now is George Bush, too. His foreign policy is George Bush, too. He's for drones. He's for American presence in Afghanistan forever. He's got Guantanamo open. I just, you know, so he knows what his legacy is, and he's going to extend that legacy by starting another war. I just don't see it. I think it goes against his natural temperament. And when we look at the gay marriage issue, you know, this guy is so conservative, temperamentally, Obama, that this is an issue that clearly he was in favor of. He's been in favor, in deep in his heart, he's been in favor of gay marriage forever, is my assumption, just based on earlier statements. And he's so timid politically, and, you know, there's a real political cost to taking that stance, but it took these other people in his administration to out him on the issue. And I feel like that's sort of what's happening on this, is that there people are really sick of his timidity on the Iran thing, and even the Israelis are speaking out. So I think the guy needs to have some backing, but I'm hoping that he will take a stand. He will continue to take a stand against a war there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it sure would be a lot better if Ron Paul was the Republican nominee than Mitt Romney, because Romney's going to be attacking him for being weak on Iran the whole time. And he'll have to say, nuh-uh, I'm tough, instead of having Ron Paul attack him as an Iran hawk and demanding that he immediately lift all the sanctions and pull the Navy away from their shores and everything else.
Right.
Get the JSOC out of there.
Well,
stop supporting
to that
MEK.
What will happen to that voice in the upcoming election?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. And, you know, I'm not... I don't know, the whole gay marriage thing, I don't think he cares one way or the other. He's just trolling for votes because he's a politician. I think, you know, to me, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are the perfect clones of each other, meaning they're both just empty suits. They're both Etch-a-Sketch guys, as somebody wrote that on my Facebook page. Both of them will say whatever the hell they think that you want to hear today, that's all. And so if that means, yeah, we'll nuke Iran, if that's what'll help him get elected, if that's what'll make him a great president, then that's what'll do. If making peace with Iran is what he thinks is better for his own personal interest, then he'll do that. So it really all comes down to, you know, these sort of, the meta narrative in the society or whatever. Are people with this or they're not? Are they scared enough to go for it or aren't they this season? You know, and that's kind of, that's your work and my work is constantly throw water on all that heat that is not worth it. You know,
don't you think the public is on our side on that one?
Yeah, I think in the general sense they are, but if you told them, if someone told them, hey man, they're making nukes, we gotta stop them, and they don't have someone right there saying, nuh-uh, that's a bunch of crap, don't believe it, then they'll believe it and be afraid, because Americans love being afraid. That's the whole game. That's what being American's all about.
Fooled them twice, shame on them.
Yeah, well, and there'll be plenty of shame to go around and lots of blood and wasted wealth and opportunities galore.
I pray you're wrong, Scott. I pray you're wrong.
Well, you know, and the thing is, too, though, I guess as long as if the official narrative really has changed to, hey, even the Israeli government admits that there's really not a crisis here, you know, maybe they just can't do it because the Iranians, I haven't seen one real reason to believe outside of some Frank Gaffney talking point, or Netanyahu one, or maybe that's the same. I haven't seen one reason to believe that they're anywhere near thinking about starting to actually try to make nuclear bombs there. They're within the non-proliferation treaty, and for years and years, hey, they even were under the additional protocol, even though it was unratified by their parliament, they still abided by it while they were negotiating with the Europeans, but they would settle for you have to halt all enrichment or else or whatever, so that eventually broke down. But in any case, all I'm trying to say is they've betrayed no intention to make nuclear bombs at all, the Iranians. They know that they could make one fast enough to beat us to dropping nukes on them if we wanted
to. There's no evidence. You know? Absolutely no evidence that they're doing that. Absolutely, yes.
So I don't know why, you know, the stasis or whatever, the status quo shouldn't just be exactly what it is. You know, really, Netanyahu's the only wild card. And then again, he's really just playing Richard Nixon pretend crazy anyway, right?
Yeah, that's true. He works that very effectively. And let's remember that this is a country that became nuclear by stealing nuclear material, enriched uranium from the United States in the 1960s, right under our noses, and no one did anything about it.
Yep.
You know, and it wasn't like they wanted to have peaceful uses of that nuke. No, they wanted to have a nuclear warhead. And, you know, now it's pretty crazy people who have a control of the nuclear warhead there.
Well, you know, I guess the conservative estimates are always a couple of hundred, but Daniel Ellsberg told me on the show that Mordecai Vanunu told him personally that it was 600 and that it included many hydrogen bombs, thermonuclear weapons.
Wow. Wow.
So now that doesn't necessarily mean tens of megatons, because I guess it could mean miniaturized, you know, very small nukes that still pack high tens of kiloton blast, but small, right?
Yeah.
But it also could mean tens and tens and tens of megatons, the kind of thing where you could kill all of Tehran in one shot, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, just these nuclear engineers are just dying to see how these little tactical ones work, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the whole thing. That's, I guess, I don't know why they call it the public choice theory. It's just the individualist theory of all of human politics, that there really is no such thing as the national interest, not even if everybody agrees on it. What there is the interest of the people doing the implementing. That's all. And the squeakiest wheel gets the grease.
I like
and
the theory.
And on and on like that. And that's what it's all about. So it's just like my favorite example lately is the Michael Hastings piece about Libya, where he talks about how Samantha Power, had been relegated to these stupid things like helping Iraqis with their stupid democracy. But she really wanted to do something important, and most of all, she wanted to be someone important in the White House again. And Libya was her chance to move back up to be at least as high as Susan Rice in the rank of women who kill people in the Obama administration. And so that's exactly what she became, and now to this day, people are, you know, there's a war still going on over who's going to be the power in Libya. And it's spreading to Mali and God knows where else from there. But that's, you know, her thing. She, it worked, though. You know what I mean? Now she's better than before or whatever.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing like human ego. I agree with you. And it is individuals. I agree. It's individuals and the sum of them. Yeah, and it's not that many who are running the show.
In fact, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say this, too, because I think it's so important and interesting. World War II is always the unquestionable thing all the time. And if you're against World War II in any way, then you're for the Holocaust somehow or some kind of crazy beyond the pale thing. And so just forget it. Everyone loves World War II and John Wayne movies and everything. But I think, and I don't know if maybe you have read it, but at least I'd like to very highly recommend to you Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. And the phrase unnecessary war actually comes from Churchill. Who said, oh, geez, huh, maybe we shouldn't have done that, derp, because what happened was they gave a war guarantee to Poland that they couldn't live up to anyway. The Brits couldn't field an army to go liberate Poland. They ended up just turning it over to the Soviets anyway, right? Poland wasn't liberated till 89.
Right.
But, so all they did was instead of having Hitler fight Stalin, and he probably would have destroyed the Soviet Union, and then, you know, if he'd gotten started 2 years earlier, fighting over, you know, their new shared border in Poland, he might have just been able to sack Moscow, and then of course ask Napoleon, no Western European army can conquer Russia. They'd all be frozen and shot to death by Russian patriots with or without a government anyway. And so it would have probably destroyed the Soviet Union and severely weakened, if not completely destroyed, Nazi Germany. Instead, they were turned westward, and so they conquered France and the Netherlands and Denmark and all of these places where Hitler never wanted to go. He always wanted to go east anyway, and it was a big, stupid blunder to promise this war guarantee to Poland and declare war on Germany over Poland. And it was, and what Pat Buchanan did is, because he knows everybody wants to criticize him and call him some kind of German sympathizer or something, so he just quotes British historians the whole time. And all they say is, boy, this was a big, stupid thing. And yet somehow it becomes ingrained as like the basis of all right actions, America for especially as Superman that can do no wrong, and of course the Israelis as the eternal victims who can do no wrong as well.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But it was a big stupid thing, and you know what it all really came down to? It was Neville Chamberlain was humiliated by the betrayal of the Munich Pact. And so in a temper tantrum, in a big huff, he went and gave a war guarantee to Poland. And in fact, the Lord Grey and all these other cabinet secretaries and the defense ministers and whoever, they all said, you did what? You just let the Polish colonels decide whether we're going to have a war with Germany or not? Are you sure? What are you doing? But he did it because he was embarrassed. It was his own personal reputation. And now everybody says, oh, you're a Chamberlain for appeasing the bad guy or whatever. When really, the worst example that Chamberlain did was make a bad decision in a time of emotion and not thinking forward to what he was doing, you know? And so the Holocaust was visited not just in the East, where it was visited anyway, but in the West as well. You know?
And Nicholson Baker's written a book about this too, hasn't he?
Is that The Human Smoke?
Yeah.
I actually have not gotten to it. I have it, but I haven't gotten to it.
I think it's a very similar argument. I have to get to that,
I mean, and, you know, it's a horrible thing that, you know, it was all the results, really, Woodrow Wilson tipping the scales in World War I in a bad way and whatever, but the way that it happened... It's one of those things, it's sort of like the Civil War. It happened so long ago that you just take it as a given. Why would you even, you know, go into critiquing the policies that led to it on either side or whatever? It's just sort of, you know, it's just a fact of history, that kind of thing. But when you actually go back and look at, you know, revisionism on the real causes of World War II, and and the arguments for it are undermined, that'll really change your perspective on a whole lot of everything, too. I mean, the Cold War becomes a ridiculous joke if World War II was a bad idea, you know?
Yeah, right, right. When Oliver Stone has made that point, you know, here was our... This is the here was the country that defeated who was the country that defeated Hitler, the Soviet Union, you know?
Right.
That Russia is what did it, you know? And then they become our big enemy as soon as the war is over.
Right. Well, and they got to enslave Europe for decades longer, and of course they were able to help Mao Zedong win the civil war in China and spread communism throughout Asia, which of course became the excuse for all of America's interventions there and all the ruthless coups and murders and proxy wars and insanity of the Cold War era, you know?
I'm with you there, man.
And then, you know, it's funny because it was our last discussion was with Jacob Hornberger here, and we were talking about how, and then when the Soviet Union was gone, the American Empire wasn't going anywhere. NATO didn't disband. It grew. And when they didn't have a terror war enemy yet, they went ahead and used drug dealers. Friggin' drug dealers as the excuse to have a world empire there for a while in the early 90s before they could, get back to the Middle East. And so on it goes. Here we are already in the future, 2012, and they seem to be saying that Al-Qaeda doesn't exist anymore. At the same time, they're saying actually Al-Qaeda exists all over Africa and the Middle East, and we're going to have to stay at war over there forever. At the same time that they're turning back to the drug war in South America as well. And the whole thing just keeps going on. America's the British Empire, really. I'm not really interviewing you anymore, am I? I'm just
I like it, man. It's good. I got to read that book.
Yeah. Well, it's the kind of thing that it's a very unpopular position to take, to undermine, because at least the way I look at it, World War II has really replaced the American Revolution and even the Civil War as the real foundational myth of America, what it is now, the empire. As it is now, and it's, you know, that's why they always compare everything to Chamberlain and everything to the great victory, even though, as you said, it was really the Russians that won the war.
They still
make it where America's Superman. That's why we had a war in Libya to save the poor civilians. That's why we need to have a war in Syria to save the poor civilians from their government, as though that's really the side we're on, the people. But it works, because people have seen so many, you know, newsreel clips and movies about our heroic liberators marching into Paris and all the people greeting them with candy and flowers and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's always 1945.
Right. Well, yeah, I think I might differ with you somewhat on that history, Scott, but we'll leave that for the next time.
Well, go ahead. We still got a couple minutes. I already blew the whole break.
You know, I just, I guess I just buy some of the narrative. I buy the narrative, and I don't find the counter narrative completely persuasive. And I haven't investigated it; it's not out of. But I guess I just buy more of the. I mean, that I think Hitler was evil. You know.
Well, that's the best part of the myth, is that the enemies obviously were evil incarnate, totalitarian societies of genocide and mass murder. I mean, look at the Japanese in China; they're no different than the Nazis. So that's the best place to have a big myth, is that our guys were really any different, because those guys were such cartoon caricatures of evil, you know?
Yeah, but I guess I'd make a distinction between that degree of evil and our guys. I just don't put us in the same category.
Yeah, okay,
just not there.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, go back to Truman in Japan and you know, the Hiroshima bombs. If the Nazis had done the Hiroshima bombs, that would have been the epitome of evil, right?
That you're right. You're right there. And that's true. That was, I mean, yeah, that's one for that column. But I guess I still would make a distinction between the... I mean, look, humankind, I hold no brief for humankind. I think it's vicious. And I think that, you know, there's some people who are good, and most people are pretty vicious and selfish. But I sort of think Hitler takes the cake on that one.
Yeah. Well, except for Stalin, you know, and Mao. I mean, Mao killed 60 million people himself. That was all of World War II. And then he went and matched that by himself over there.
Wow. Yeah. Good point. See, I have more reading to do.
Yeah, anyway, I know, it's all very tough. I mean, you really want to go back to it. I'm a revisionist on the Constitution. I'd have rather kept the Articles of Confederation. I think that's when we went from Republic to Empire right there. It's been aggressive war ever since, and I know I'm not going to radicalize you that bad, so.
Well, you're just above my pay grade in terms of knowledge now.
Well, no, it's just, I don't know about that. I'm sure that's not true. But anyway, all right, well, listen, so, I don't know, if you could tell us in a couple of minutes, maybe for people who really don't know about this, who really do kind of need a 101, can you tell us what's life like for a Palestinian? You've been there.
I think what life is like for a Palestinian, quite simply, is that you grow up in a family in the West Bank, typically, or in Gaza, which is even worse. You grow up in a family. You get a really great education. This is a society that values education. You're going to university, and you can walk up to the top of your house, the terrace or the rooftop of your house, and you can see the Mediterranean Sea, and you can see Jerusalem a few miles away, and you can't go there. That's life for a Palestinian. That's all you need to know. Some of the most promising young Arabs in the world, part of the Arab Spring, these people are living in imprisoned. And you can't contain that type. That's cruel. That's oppressive. It's outrageous. And when Hillary Clinton says the situation is unsustainable, she is making a huge understatement about conditions that are just outrageous. That shocked the human conscience, and that shocked the human conscience the way slavery did in our country 150 years ago, to the point where you had white people in the North who were willing to give up their lives to destroy that institution, revolutionaries who wanted to give up their lives to destroy the institution. That's the type of injustice that we're seeing in Palestine. It is drawing worldwide attention. It is going to be resolve violently unless people get their heads around this and realize how these people are being oppressed and what we are doing to blight the lives of young idealistic Palestinians.
Yeah, you know, back to our conversation before about, you know, what Americans know about this thing. The only time they ever show us Palestinians is if they're throwing rocks at a tank, which somehow is supposed to symbolize their aggression. I don't know. Or, you know, if there's a full-scale intifada and there's some suicide bombings going on once every 10 years or 15 years or so when that breaks out, then they'll put that on the news. But meanwhile, they protest peacefully, Gandhi style, MLK style, all the time. And you can read about it, but you never get to see it on TV, right?
I agree with you. Exactly. I mean, you know, there's Tahrir Square has been going on there for years without the oxygen of international attention. You know, you have small villages rising up against the fact that their well water has been taken away from them. What more fundamental principle of human life is there than access to your village lands and waters and your ancient olive trees that your great-grandfathers planted being cut down by these oppressors? It's just, it's shocking, and there is no attention given to the nonviolent movement to oppose this.
That's Philip Weiss. MondoWeiss.net. Thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Scott.
Talk to you
again. Have a great weekend.